Turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. Last week we saw the end of David's reign. And the way 1 Kings begins is with the transition of the kingdom from David to Solomon. And it tells about the end of David's life. Absalom tried to take the kingdom away from David, and ended up Absalom was killed in the civil war that followed. Adonijah was Absalom's brother, younger brother, and he tried to take the kingdom as David was basically lying on his sick bed just shortly before his death. He tried to take the kingdom, and so there was some emergency measures, basically. David acted very quickly under the guidance of Nathan the prophet, and they established Solomon as the king of Israel. And so 1 Kings really starts with the reign of Solomon. Now, one other quick thing just for your help as you think through scriptures. You take the each of the four books of Samuel and Kings, and they are divided at major transition periods. So 1 Samuel ends with the death of King Saul. And 2 Samuel begins with the coronation of David. 2 Samuel ends with the end of David's reign. And it really does. It ends his reign, and 1 Kings begins with the beginning of Solomon's reign. 1 Kings ends with basically the end of the ministry of, I always mix the two up, Elisha. And 2 Kings begins with the beginning of the ministry of Elijah. I think that's the right order. They're not, as you can maybe recalling from what we've already studied in 1 and 2 Samuel, it's not a clean break in every case, but that's basically what's going on, is you're seeing a transition from one major leader to another, at each of those major breaks. So just to fill in one more gap here maybe as you're thinking about it, 1 and 2 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles deals entirely with the reign of David. So 1 Chronicles ends with basically the death of David. 2 Chronicles begins with the rise of Solomon, the installation of Solomon as king. And much of 2 Chronicles, certainly the early part of 2 Chronicles, is all about Solomon. But a good chunk of 2 Chronicles is focused on the reign of Solomon, and then it very quickly moves through the reign of the other kings of Judah. And this is one of the big differences between 1 and 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles is focused exclusively on the kingdom governed by Jerusalem, the southern kingdom. The descendants of David ruled the kingdom of Jerusalem. 1 and 2 Kings talks about not just the descendants of David reigning over Judah, but also the 10 tribes of Israel. After the kingdom was divided, they were reigned over by usurpers. And it goes through the history of the northern kingdom as well as the southern kingdom. And so it will come back to that in later weeks and talk about that a little bit more fully. But so what we have here in 1 Kings is really the introduction to Solomon's kingdom. And in 1 Kings chapter 3, we now see Solomon really establishing himself as the king. And one of the things that's important is in this is the age of Solomon. Now, it's important even though we don't know exactly how old he is. There are some that have said Solomon was 8 or 9 years old at this time when he became king. I don't think he was. Some have said Solomon was as old as 30. I don't think he was that old either. I would place, if you remember when we were talking about David's sin with Bathsheba, I said David was about 50 when that happened. And David died at age 70 after reigning for 40 years. So that would put Solomon as a late teenager around the, so we'll say 18 years old. And there's, I can't be dogmatic on that, though I definitely will argue with you if you want to argue a date, an age. But that's roughly, that's how old I see Solomon, at this point, 18 years old or so. So he's not a child, but he is certainly not what we would consider and what that culture would have considered a full-grown adult either. I mean, he is not yet matured, in all respects. And so chapter 3 of 1 Kings, it says, "Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days." That's an important point. It's going to come to play later in Solomon's reign here. But we have that there are sacrifices taking place around Israel in various places. They're not, it was supposed to take place at the tabernacle, but they weren't just sacrificing at the tabernacle. They were sacrificing in multiple places. You remember last week, we saw that David, made sacrifice on the threshing floor of Arunah. And he just bought that threshing floor for that specific purpose. And we know that that became the Temple Mount, but that was just one of the places where sacrifices were being offered because until there had not yet been that house of the Lord built. Even the tabernacle and the furnishings of the tabernacle were somewhat divided. You have the tabernacle in, I believe, Gibeah, and the Ark of the Covenant was in Jerusalem. It was David, you remember David brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. And so you have sacrifices going on in those two places as well. But verse 3, it says, "And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places." Solomon followed his father's example and walked in obedience to God. And it does make a point this of saying that he did make offerings at the high places. And there is a sense here in this where God is permitting this. It is certainly contrary to what was prescribed in the law, but for this period of time, God is permitting this and is not rebuking Israel because of their offering sacrifices at different places. And so we have verse 4. "Now the king went to Gibeon." I said Gibeah earlier. It should have been Gibeon. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. And so Solomon inherits a prosperous kingdom. And in which if you remember the end of 2 Samuel, you know David has won victories. It has been a great time for Israel, and that continues here early in Solomon's reign. They are prospering. And so verse 5, "At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, 'Ask, what shall I give you?' And Solomon said, 'You have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is now this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?'" So God comes to Solomon and says, "Whatever you want, I will give it to you." It's an incredible promise. What does Solomon ask for? Wisdom. He recognizes his own limitations. And this statement, he says that I'm a little child, is one reason why some people think that Solomon was literally a little child, 8 or 9 years old, or maybe a little bit younger. I think that was poetry on Solomon's part. He's recognizing his own littleness, and clearly he's recognizing his own inability to really lead as he should. And you think about the example of his father David. David was an incredible king. He was not just a mighty warrior. We see in his interactions and in his planning that he was truly a great king. He was a skilled administrator and leader. Despite his failures in leading in his home, he still was very, very definitely a great and a godly leader. And I think Solomon is looking at some of that and saying, basically, these are some big shoes to fill. I can't do this. And he is rightly, he's showing wisdom and rightly looking around and understanding the demands of being a king and what is really he is obligated to do in caring for the people of Israel, and is saying, I can't do this. And so he asks for wisdom. Put a bookmark or keep your finger there in 1 Kings 3 and go over to Proverbs chapter 4, verse 3. Proverbs 4, verse 3, there's one other aspect here that I think is driving Solomon's request. Because he is, as I said, acting wisely. He has been attentive to the teaching of his father and his mother. You read through Proverbs and you definitely see indications that Bathsheba taught him wisdom and taught him to seek wisdom. But Proverbs chapter 4, verse 3, it says, when I was my father's son, tender, and the only one in the sight of my mother. So when I was but a little lad, is what he was saying. They were saying, when I was under David's instructions, when I was there, beloved in the sight of my mother Bathsheba, he also taught me. David taught me and said to me, let your heart retain my words, keep my commandments, and live. And then he gives him, verse 5, two very emphatic commands. Get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget, nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, that's wisdom. Do not forsake wisdom, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And in all you're getting, get understanding. Exalt her and she will promote you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her. You will place on your head she will place on your head an ornament of grace, a crown of glory she will deliver to you. So David has taught Solomon, and apparently quite insistently has taught Solomon, pursue wisdom. The chief thing that you can get is wisdom. And there's a sense here where David is instructing him, what do you need to be a king? You think about all the temptations, all the things kings desire. Territories, taxes, they love taxes. Armies, large harems, feasts, and retainers, they love the praise of men. They heap to themselves all kinds of things. Power drives them in so many cases. And David goes to his young child Solomon. And David knows Solomon is going to be the king. It's clearly, we skipped it, but it's clearly indicated in 1 Kings chapter 1 that David has known from apparently Solomon's birth, or before Solomon's birth, I would argue, that Solomon was going to be the next king. And so David is teaching him, here's what you need. When you become king, there's one thing you need to get. It's not power. It's not land. It's not riches. You do not need to fight for glory and honor and praise. You need wisdom. And if you do so, if you get wisdom, verses 8 and 9 of Proverbs 4, then wisdom will promote you. She will give you this crown of glory. She will give you honor. So seek wisdom, and in the receipt of wisdom, you will find these other things that kings desire. Which is, if you know the history of Solomon, you find that's exactly what happened. And by contrast, if you know the history of Solomon's son Rehoboam, you see that in the forsaking of wisdom, it's the loss of glory and honor. So that Solomon himself, he walks in wisdom and he grows and prospers and does incredibly well. And then the second half of his reign, he begins to turn away from wisdom, begins to practice idolatry. And his kingdom begins to suffer. And the only reason he does not lose it all is because of David. Because God says, for David's sake, I'm not going to take this kingdom from you, but I'm taking it from your son. And his son Rehoboam pops up on the scene after Solomon's death, and he plays the part of a fool. And the kingdom is divided. So then now out of 12 tribes, all that is left of the dynasty of David is two tribes. The vast majority of it is taken away because of folly. And so I think Solomon had heard and understood his father's instructions. So go back to 1 Kings chapter 3. And he has understood that I desperately need wisdom. And verse 10 of 1 Kings 3, it says, the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done, behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. So Solomon, God says, I'm going to make you wise like none other. An incredible promise. And we also see verse 13, God says, I've also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So if you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. So he makes really the part of the Mosaic covenant. The book of Deuteronomy says, if you walk in the commands of the Lord, he will make your days long. You will prosper in the land which God has given you. So God is telling Solomon the same thing. If you obey me, if you walk in obedience to my commands, I will make your days long. You will prosper in this land. And so chapter 3 is all about the wisdom of Solomon that is given to him by God. And in this second half of this chapter is an incredible illustration of the wisdom given to Solomon. And it tells the story of two women who come to Solomon seeking justice. And these two women, they're both prostitutes. They are both pregnant at the same time, and they both give birth at nearly the same time, 3 days apart. And they come to Solomon with a dead baby and a live baby. I don't think, probably the dead baby wasn't actually there, but, they come to him with these two children. One says that her baby died, and she took my live baby from me and claims it's hers and put the dead baby in bed with me and said, that's my baby. And it's not. The live baby is mine. The other one says, no, the live baby is mine. Her baby died. And this is rightly my child. Now, there's nobody else there. It's an incredibly difficult situation because they both give birth alone. The only other person in the room there is the other side of this argument, the other individual in this argument. There's nobody except for these two women who are able to say whose child is whose. There's no testimony that can be given. This is the worst of the she said circumstances. And I know in at times in marriage counseling, as I'm talking with people, you know, and they give me two stories that cannot both be true. It just, and they both might be wrong, but they certainly both cannot be true. And the only, you know, I hear a story of something that happened in their house, you know, when it was just the two of them. And he says, well, she did this. And she says, no, I did this. Who's telling me the truth? I don't know. I mean, it's just one of the brutal realities is I have no idea. I might have a guess as to who I think is more likely to be telling the truth. And depending on where we are in the counseling process, I might be more convinced of, you know, to trust one person's words over another. But I don't have any idea. And I can try to dig in and figure out who's telling me, who's actually giving me an accurate story here. But the odds are, I'm not going to know. That's just, I'm just going to be sitting there thinking, okay, one of you's lying to me, at least one of you. And I don't know, have any way of figuring it out. And if you've ever been in a situation like that, you know, I mean, it's powerless. What am I going to do? How am I going to sort this out and figure out who's telling the truth here? Solomon's in that situation. That's exactly where he is. This is very early in his reign. And now he is confronted with this impossible problem of justice. So what does he do? All right, you both claim the child. I'm going to each give you half. And split the baby. And you know, one says, that's fine. The other says, no, I'd rather the child live than go to her than die. And Solomon's conclusion from that, that interaction then is what? Yeah, the one who wants the child to live must be the mother. And this is, it's a familiar story. I mean, so much so that, I mean, I say, well, let's split the baby. People know what we're talking about. Even people that maybe don't have a deep biblical knowledge would at least have some inkling of what we're talking about here. And yet there's an incredible insight that Solomon is showing. Because it is absolutely possible that he could be talking to two people who are unwilling to see a baby killed at any price. So part of what he has to recognize here is that there's malice. So that one of them is actually going to say, oh yeah, let's kill the baby. But that's an unthinkable thing. And I would not legitimately offer it as a solution to anything. And I think in our culture, if you say, here's a baby, there's two ladies, they're both arguing about it, that both of them are going to say, no, don't cut the baby in half. That's crazy. And yet, in that particular situation, Solomon is showing the insight into the heart of the individuals to recognize that the true mother is going to desire the life of the child, and the false mother is going to be willing to, or the claimant is going to be willing to see the child die rather than see the true mother have her child. There's an incredible insight. It's not just he poses a creative solution. It's a solution that is backed by genuine understanding into the people that he's talking to and dealing with. And so we have the end of chapter 3, verse 28. This really becomes a noteworthy decision. This is famous for Solomon, so that all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king. For they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. And again, he is in probably one of the most impossible situations as a judge, to choose between two people with no evidence to guide you, merely two competing claims. And yet he judges rightly, which again, having been in that situation, though not involving children or babies, having been in similar situations, that's astounding. It's absolutely astounding that he would be able to rightly decide. It is clearly of God that he has this wisdom. And so the response of Israel is this proper fear, this respect to the king, because now they see that he is appointed of God and he is directed by God. It's a crucial point in the reign of Solomon, not just for establishing his wisdom, but for establishing the fact that he is the God-appointed king. So I'm going to take the rest of our time and we're going to start talking a little bit about wisdom, because that's really, you know, we sit here in chapter 3 and we need to think about how this applies to our own life, because probably none of us are going to be in that kind of situation Solomon's in, at least certainly not in the specifics of it. The humility of Solomon we see very present. He's saying, I don't know what to do. I'm just a child. I have no idea how to handle these people at all. This incredible humility that recognizes I'm in over my head and acknowledges it. And that really is humility. And it's actually quite rare. How many people do you see? How many times do you see someone that gets in a situation where they clearly have no clue, but they sure are going to act like it. They're going to fake it. And they're going to try to put on this appearance that, yeah, I know what I'm supposed to do. I know what I'm talking about. And, you know, if anybody actually does know what's being talked about, they can listen to that person and say, they don't have a clue. It's obvious from the way they're talking about this that they're just making things up and trying to fit in. And yet to go and to say, I don't have a clue, to honestly admit, I don't know, is vital to having wisdom. Yeah, the humility, again, it's vital in all of this understanding of wisdom and having wisdom. James chapter 1, verse 5 says, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraideth not. That's the other aspect of wisdom that we see in 1 Kings. If Solomon asked for it, you know, we understand God initiated this conversation, but Solomon says, I need wisdom. Give me wisdom. And there's an incredible promise as we start thinking about wisdom, that we recognize God promises to give it to us. I mean, this is one of those things like humility. If we ask for it, God will give it to us. God will give us wisdom. There's a promise there. And so go to Proverbs chapter 1. As we think about wisdom and begin to, and I'm not going to finish this at all this week. We're going to take maybe this week and next, maybe the rest of December. I don't know right now. We'll see how long it takes us to do this. But I want to quickly walk through and give us some understanding of what wisdom genuinely is. And in Proverbs chapter 1, it's written, the Proverbs are written, in verse 2 it says, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. That's what he's doing. Proverbs is written to give wisdom. And so as we think about wisdom, we see it at work in Solomon's life. One of the things that it should do is it should say, hey, this is the wisest guy that's ever lived. Far and above, you know, outside of Jesus himself, this is the wisest man that has ever been on the face of the earth. Confucius was an idiot compared to Solomon. And I'm not being sarcastic. I mean that. Solomon is the single greatest source, human source, of genuine wisdom that can ever be found. So if I go to God and say, I want wisdom, please give me wisdom, and I have available to me an entire text written by the wisest man to ever live that has the express purpose of instructing me in wisdom, what should I do with that text? Study it. Yeah. I should fill my mind with these words. And I will say, I would also add in there definitely the reading of Ecclesiastes. It's a different take on wisdom, but it's the wisest man's investigation of life, and there is incredible wisdom there. But for the sake of our conversation right now, we're going to focus in Proverbs. So let me give you a definition of wisdom. Somebody find for me Proverbs 15 verse 2, and be ready to read that. Proverbs 15 verse 2. But a basic definition of wisdom is knowledge rightly applied. It's not original with me by any means. I learned that definition years and years ago, and it wasn't original with the person who taught it to me or the person who taught it to them. But what we talk about with wisdom is the ability to take information, whatever that information may be, and then rightly apply it to a specific situation. So we go back to the example of 1 Kings chapter 3. Solomon had knowledge. He had some understanding of the individuals before him, and I assume he had an understanding of their character. And then he was able to take that knowledge of them and rightly apply it in a specific situation to reach a just conclusion. The tongue of the tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly. That's wisdom. The wise one has knowledge, and then when he speaks and applies that knowledge rightly. He uses it well. He uses it properly. Now, we need to understand, as we're thinking about this knowledge that we are this wisdom, we are talking about more than, you know, the practical advice for living. Now, there's a lot of that in Proverbs, but it's more than just here's how you handle finances. As you can go to a secular financial counselor, and he can give you good knowledge and rightly applied knowledge about how to form a budget, how to invest your money, how to save, how to work out a retirement plan. And in a sense, that there is wisdom there, but we're talking about something other than secular human wisdom. We're talking about godly wisdom. And so that now it is a matter of taking this knowledge and rightly applying it to a specific situation in light of our relationship and obligations to God. So there is absolutely a moral component to wisdom and to Proverbs. So as we go to the Proverbs and we read these things, it's not just telling us that a wise man is diligent in his work and a fool is lazy. That certainly does say that. There's an aspect there that this true wisdom produces a diligence because this wise one fears God. And that's Proverbs 1 verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, beginning of knowledge, sorry. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. So where does genuine wisdom start? What's its foundation? The fear of the Lord. Which, go to Romans chapter 1. By contrast, those who do not fear God cannot have true wisdom. Again, I do not mean everything they say is going to be wrong, that they're always going to give bad advice, that they can never discover anything about the world or men that is accurate, but they will never have true wisdom. And that's why I made unkind remarks about Confucius's intellect. Because he did not fear God. Romans chapter 1, verse 21. It says, because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Is futile thinking a synonym for wisdom? No, it's an antonym. It's the opposite. He says their foolish hearts are now dark, so they cannot rightly understand. They cannot rightly apply the facts that they have because they have rejected God. They see His handiwork. They knew God. It's all around. But they refused Him. And their thinking became empty and vain. Their hearts became foolish and darkened, so that, verse 22, professing to be wise, they became fools. And that's worth remembering when you watch the political pundits on TV or politicians in general. If they're not saved, if they do not fear God, there's no real wisdom there. And we need to take, whatever we are hearing, whatever opinions and editorial comments we are hearing and reading, we need to come at them, recognize, unless this person is the child of God, which in many cases, the vast majority of them, I think we have strong evidence that they are not the child of God and they do not fear God, that what they are offering to us is not genuine wisdom. It comes from a foolish heart. Now, I understand that we don't just take everything and throw it away. Well, that comes from an unsaved person. They can't know anything. I'm not saying that. But they cannot give any genuine wisdom if they do not first fear God.